So things didn't work out, and Amy and I, we were living in Toledo. We moved to Lansing because she got a job as a librarian at a domestic violence resource place. And but in that transition, we decided to separate, and I went back to the house, you know, in, on Roeder Street in Monroe that I lived at, that at my folks' house. You know, after my mom died, Dad and my sister Brenda lived at home, and Dad just started living in his truck and just didn't come home anymore, and Brenda had the house. So I went and stayed with her, and then I took a trip to Anza Borrego. I caught a ride with my dad, and we rode around to the desert Southwest. It was in January. Just to kind of put my head together, I wanted to go off camping by myself, and I wanted to make it more of kind of a spiritual retreat, because in Aleister Crowley's book 4, it really gets into Eluxat, like, what was it about Moses and Muhammad and the Buddha and Jesus that allowed them to go out and change the world? There was no point of doctrine that all of them believed. They believed very different things, but they all did the same thing. They went off into the wilderness and they came back changed, and then they implemented from there. And so I went to Anza Borrego both to like clear my head, to have a place in the winter camping. John had recommended it as a nice place to camp in January, and my dad got rides through near there because he used to deliver near Palm Springs. So he dropped me off there, and I camped by myself, I think for about 3 weeks. And it was just windy, and it's still winter camping, even though it's like 70 degrees in the daytime. It got cold at night. You know, my gallon of water would freeze through, but the wind would be blowing, and I just felt it kind of like blow through me, and I let go of a lot of stuff. And I wanted to own my own hurt so that I didn't carry any kind of bitterness or resentment. And I wanted to just kind of feel it and let it go. And also to be open myself up to, you know, because I had been, now I was about 30, you know. If I was, what Jesus did is, you know, he became spiritually aware, and then he studied and then for 30 years, and then he did an ambitious plan of healing people, feeding people, and telling people stories. So I was about 30, and times were weird. There was 9/11 had happened, and the world seemed to be changing. And something that had really impressed upon my thinking during my breakdown days was that the you know, I remember being sleeping in front of the TV, and I woke up, and it was like the year 2000 was flashing. This was 1996, you know, where you, and with Y2K and just the change of millennium, I felt like that was something. You know, and so I explored that, and spent a lot of time just being open to the universe and praying. And I was wandering around following ravens in the desert. I mean, you can only go hiking so many times and reading, and you're by yourself and talking to the camp ranger for about 5 minutes a day, some days not. So I was following these ravens and having, you know, this, I'd been in this really open spiritual place, and it just came to me that this is not any time to because I remember going back to my Bible as literature class, one of the points that Dr. Roberti made that really struck me about Jesus is that Jesus was who he was, and there was also the times. It was not that the times were right for that message that could move things. And so that just helped me kind of see that the time, this is not the time, you know, and that 30 is an arbitrary number. Moses was in his 40s and 50s, and Muhammad was in his 40s, I think. Buddha, I don't know how old he was. I'm only using those folks as exemplars, you know, because and models. And you know, I think if you want to implement a change process or decide who you are as a person, and that's what I'm talking about when I'm telling this story and what I'm doing. You know, take into account the conditions of the world and the things that I think are existential threats to all of our existence, or that are affronts against what I would consider God's justice or human justice. That there are people who have nothing and struggle for their very existence, and they are our brothers and sisters and have a right and a need for that assistance in a system that they can be successful and not have to be afraid. Everybody, all the time, everywhere. What do you do with those kinds of things, you know? So for me, I've decided that from time to time, you know, I'm going to pull back and I'm going to reflect, and I'm going to make concrete changes in my life based upon those reflections. And so, you know, as I follow the ravens around, and I found this Mortero stone, which, you know, whenever they say they don't understand, but they're like the mortar stones that the natives would indigenous folks would pound grain with, and this was a little one, you know, which they said that probably had symbolic powers. And I just kind of carried around it and used it as a worry stone, and I just felt that did that now, and that I was on the right path, and to keep doing what I'm doing, studying and learning and trying to help. And I have some idea of a date of when I think, you know, I think that the millennium was important. And as we have more people who were born in the new millennium and look at us who are bringing these kinds of ancient destructive ideas about accumulating things and having stuff and engaging in this process of extraction and manufacture and distribution and consumption and disposable in such a way that puts the entire continued existence of life on the planet Earth at risk, to meet some unmet psychological and emotional needs and feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, and have shelter, in this short-term, destructive, not even very fun way. I think younger people are going to reject this, and there's going to be a mass movement, and that seems like the times that, because I think you can't stay in the pocket, you know. When I was burning brightly, when I was mad, and when it's come upon me of times when, like when I've been campaigning, or other times when you're, or when I've been organizing giant protests, or when I've been reading, doing a lot of poetry, and you're making these powerful emotional connections and doing things, then there's the feeling that goes along with that, and you feel it. If it's like a fire, you know, you can't keep that fire going year after year after year, you know. I got in the pocket in politics, to jump ahead a little bit, and I was on, you know, 40, 50 hours a week plus a 40-hour-a-week job, and I was sleeping and working all the time, and it was really engaging and fun, and I got a lot done, but it was maddening, too. So I learned a lot in Anza Borrego, and I healed some, and I felt validated that I was on the right path, and that this was not the time to go all in into trying to implement a plan of spiritual and cultural transformation to get us on a path towards equity and sustainability. So I came back from the trip. I worked, I lived with my sister Brenda. My old boss had started a private practice, and so I had gotten a social work licensure in the state of Michigan. So I started doing family counseling, a lot of abuse and neglect cases, and I started doing batter intervention, which was really amazing to go through separation and divorce with a group of guys who were also often in separation or divorce or struggling in a relationship, and modeling, taking on patriarchy and male privilege. And it really helped me grow as a man to help these dangerous and abusive men who also had a lot of love in the heart and the desire to be good parents and husbands and boyfriends, or just peaceful people, or maybe they didn't even see that they had a problem, but when when the process went on and they had to own up to at least that one thing, because nobody got there by not having to do at least one terrible thing. And all of them admitted that they were had engaged in behaviors that controlling assholes did. And they could learn not to do that. And we could do that in a group and support each other and tell our stories and hold ourselves accountable, and that that was a good and powerful thing. And so I did that for a number of years. And then when I moved out to work for CAN, I had talked my brother John and his partner to come out and organize, because they are great organizers, and I knew this movement was cooking and it was a chance for room and board and free weed. And so they did, and John and Marcia stayed out there, and ultimately they broke up and Marcia moved further up the West Coast, but John stayed out there and he worked for Dr. Todd McAria, who was really one of the most significant and earliest medical marijuana practitioners. He had turned Jack Harrar onto the idea of medical marijuana, the guy who wrote The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and he was authored the phrase, "In any condition for which marijuana provides relief," in Prop 215, which opened, because there's not the research on marijuana, so you have to be able to try it out. And he considered marijuana an easement, which means even if it didn't have any ability to treat, that just being high makes you feel better when you're sick, and it's just easier and you're in a better place and a more relaxed and open state. And if you're dealing with a terrible illness, that's a pretty good place to be. So John talked me into going out and working with Dr. Todd in the clinic. And so I moved back to California, kind of steered clear of my old crowd because I didn't know how things had ended awkwardly. And I have a little bit of regrets about that, because I could have reestablished some friendships while I was there, and I didn't. And now I, talk to him on Facebook, and it's just, but water under the bridge. So worked at the marijuana clinic, and we would do medical marijuana evaluations, and I would do the blood pressures and schedule appointments and follow up for the people who had high BPs and they were trying to treat the pot doctor like he was their primary care doctor. And I would say, no, you got a primary care need. You need to get in with the doctor, and I'd follow up and do. So we did good medical practice, and it added to my kind of interest in chronic disease management, or it was really the first time I kind of did that. Got into some biofeedback. Dr. Todd was willing to, he was an early innovator on that field, and I took a class on biofeedback, and it was really cool, because a lot of the things that I had done with relaxation and states of consciousness, it was cool to demonstrate that on the machine. So when I did alpha wave training, you would put on the thing that would measure your alpha waves, and it would put up your alpha waves as a blue bar, and if you could close your eyes, and that raises your alpha waves by about 10%. And then the trick is, to using passive volition, you allow the bar to grow higher, and you allow the alpha waves to be created, and this thing that is unconscious becomes under your conscious control through, they call it passive volition. It's an act of the will, but it's an allowance rather than a making. And so it was fun, because I put it on and rose the bar at will the first time I tried, and learned some stuff about hand warming that because you can control migraines by moving blood to your hands, so you can check that by hand temperature. And so it was neat, and it added to a lot of these things that I had already been doing just by noticing the bodily symptoms and using that as how your body is, the warmth of your hand. That had come to me during my manic breakdown, and that I noticed, like, my motivational speaker's voice, I would call it. When I would speak in front of a large group, my palms would sweat, and I would, because I was afraid of speaking to the group, but then I would take a deep breath, and I said, fear plus oxygen equals ecstasy, and I was intrigued by that idea of ecstasy that I had felt in drugs, but also had felt at other times, like speaking really well, or really doing a great presentation or performance or speech in front of a crowd that's feeling, it's that same kind of feeling of ecstasy. And I realized that it was an overcoming of that as fear. So I had doubts about wanting to live in California because some things I didn't like about it is the rubbing your nose of the disparities. You know, there's a lot of homeless people, a lot of aggressive panhandlers, a lot of very rich people, a lot of things, you know, this big class divide, and it's just right there and you can't really get away from it. And everything's expensive, so it seems like there's this focus on money that's more so than any place that I've been. Plus, it's really beautiful, and there's lots of things to do, and it's the heart of, you know, you can find anybody who's into anything. I had a great Dungeons & Dragons group and got engaged with political stuff and saw great shows and went to all of the wilderness areas in the West, and it was a great time, but it wasn't as changed the world as I like to be. And I also knew that my dad living in his truck was not going to be a sustainable solution. And so I quit Dr. Todd and had saved up a little bit of money. I didn't make much, so I didn't have a lot of money. And then I went backpacking in Big Sur. It was a lot like my trip to Anza Borrego, only this time, rather than just kind of reading books, and I think I took a Bible to Anza Borrego, I took the spiritual exercises of Ignatius of Loyola, the thing that the spiritual coach through, that the Jesuits do for 30 days, and I thought I would self-coach myself. I had pulled the book. I was at a training when I was at Cortez and Associates at a Catholic school, and I went in their library, and I pulled off his meditations, and I opened this page, and I read this one page on humility, and it was just powerful about, you know, having the three levels of humility. You know, one is treating other people like yourself, and then one is like only allowing yourself what you need, because you, and then third, you know, all, and then third is always taking the worst thing in the service, you know, of a higher purpose, so you can only have as much, you know, it's better to be sick than well, it's better to be poor than rich, to be, you know, that's the highest form of humility. And it was just, so I took those exercises, and I was by myself, and I was camping. And one of the spiritual exercises is this thing called a colloquy, which is a form of prayer of this kind of imaginary conversation. And it's I don't want to give too much away about what they are, because when you take the exercises, you're supposed to take them as you're not knowing what they are. So I didn't read ahead once I read that part in the book, and I just read them as I went. So I don't want to get into too much there, but it would involve these colloquies and these amazing conversations. And so I was by myself, and I was engaged in this organized spiritual practice of meditating on the themes that would go on for like 4 days. And you're doing visualizations and reading and thinking about it while you're hiking in this beautiful, in the redwoods, and drinking, you know, out of the pure mountain streams, and only eating what you can carry. And it was just this, you know, amazing experience. And I started to realize that I was making a break with the real world and how things are organized, of like owning a house or going to a job or being able to, you know, because when I had my manic breakdown, you know, you're in a world of one and nobody else is on your vibe, and it's frightening and scary. I think that same thing comes from, you know, Freud says religion is insanity, so I felt like I was getting to that point where I was going to make this breakthrough, and I was going to be very much organized to be different. And again, I just felt like the world said it doesn't have to happen now, you know, that this is, and so I stepped back from that. I planned to do the 30-day thing and do the whole, with no thought in mind beyond just doing these exercises. And I stopped after 2.5 weeks, and I called my dad, and he was happening to be headed to Fresno. And I thought, well, I may never get a chance to have another trip with my dad. And so I started hitchhiking to Fresno. And it was funny because I got a ride. You know, I'm a camper, I've been living out of my backpack, and I've been going to these resorts and having a meal maybe once a week, and when I would resupply, and you're like a middle-class guy when you're walking around the woods with a backpack, and people treat you like you're a middle-class guy. And I got in a car, with the guy, and I'm a middle class guy hitchhiking from some, you know, and feel like, oh, I've been backpacking, I got dropped off, I didn't know how long I was going to stay. It's a totally cool thing to do. I got out of this car in Santa Cruz and I was a homeless person because I'm dirty and I have a backpack, and suddenly without me changing, I dropped like 8 pegs in social order. And but I leave my backpack and I walked into a Denny's. And I had been washing in streams, you know, for 3 weeks, and I washed in the sink and with the warm water, and this slew of, I thought I was clean, you know, but this slew of brown came off, and I realized I had this thin film of dust that I had for weeks. And I literally teared up. I was in such an emotion about the beauty of plumbing, that any person with a backpack can stumble into a Denny's and wash with warm water. And it was and I sat down and I ate my dinner at Denny's, and I had this experience like Jesus was there having dinner, you know. It was this intense kind of colloquy. And Robert Anton Wilson talks about it. He says, pick anybody, read everything they ever wrote, you know, read everything that anybody who knew them, what they had to say about them. Meditate on those words. Memorize those words. Focus your consciousness on that person. And that person will speak to you. And, you know, and so, you know, my mom, you know, hearing, knowing what my mom would say about different things. And I do this with my brother, where I'll say what my mom would say about something, you know, in my imitation. And he can do it to me. And we know. And then, so we have that. And Jesus is such a figure, you know, of in literature and society and in Christian society, and then something that's animated and intrigued me. And so that was an interesting and powerful experience. I took that trip with my dad, and we... it was the last trip I got to ride with him, rode with him for about 2 weeks, and got out in Eugene, Oregon, and hooked up with my friends John and Lisa. I made some music with John when they lived in Toledo. He is a great ethnomusicologist and just a great musical partner. And we'd done a bunch of metaphysical roots music in the style of the Carter family. And so it was good to reconnect with them. And then their friend was driving a U-Haul to the Bay Area, and so I caught a ride with her and told her the story of my life thus far, and that a lot of the things that I've talked about, and really had this great kind of bonding experience. And then I so much kind of wanted, she was moving there, and wanted to stay because it felt like we made a connection, but I just left from there, you know. So caught a train to Toledo, Ohio, and Mr. Harry Train picked me up at the airport, and who was living with his sister in South Toledo, and stayed in his basement for a few days. Well, I called Sarah Vance about taking her up on letting me crash with her if I was going to start a new life in Columbia, Missouri, and stopped and worked some construction with Eric Hempel and Champagne. Tried to hitchhike to Columbia, but got rusted by the cops, and ended up coming into Columbia on a Greyhound in January of 2006.